morning and welcome to Under the Olive Tree, the Canadian Palestinian radio show. You are listening to CKUT Radio McGill 90.3 FM from Montreal. Today is Thursday, November 24th, 2005 at 11 a.m. and I'm your host for the hour, Laith Maarouf. Under the Olive Tree is a project with two aims: to provide the Palestinian community with access to the skills and equipment of radio, and at the same time to provide them the space to produce content that truly represents them. If you'd like to get involved or have comments, please email us at uot@ckut.ca. Again, that's uot@ckut.ca. Today's show has a great lineup of music, poetry, and interviews. We have an interview with Professor Simone Sharoni on her upcoming lecture at Concordia University next Tuesday, November 29th. The lecture is titled The Challenge of Solidarity, The Struggle of Peace and Justice in Palestine, and we will explain that a little bit more. And an interview with a photographer, Montreal photographer Darren L., who will be exhibiting his photos from Palestine starting from the 29th of November and ending on the 1st of December at the G.A. Desev Theater in UQAM. And we will explain that also as we get to it. And our final parts of our show are all dedicated to the music and poetry that was part of the SPHR fundraising event entitled We Shall Remain. There's great poetry coming up and great music. We will listen to all of these different poets from Toronto and Montreal. Again, my name is Laith Maarouf. I'm your host at Under the Olive Tree this week. Please stay with us. We'll be back soon.
All right, the next song we're going to do for you is called Free Olive Dam. Dam meaning blood in Arabic, olives being olives, so you can figure that one out for yourself. It's called Free Olive Dam.
"100 years ago, they came up with a plan to make a nationality for our people with our land. On a land with no people is what they say. But the truth was not so, but instead there were many people that were living there before. Didn't they have farms and fields where many crops did grow? Now it's been thrown down on West memory. That is why I say, free olive dam for this suffering so long. Free olive dam for this suffering so long. Upon the realization, people that were living there, they had to make a decision about the land they had to share, to impose a majority in this new country. They had to make the population flee, yes, make them refugees. The root of the problem was born in this moment of shame. That's a point of no return. Blood that's been shed, violence carried out in my name. That's why I say, free Palestine for their suffering so. Free Olive Dam for their suffering so. Nobody does anything about it, for they're suffering so long, so long. And so it goes. Plan is almost realized, still there is hope. Always overcomes the lies for those who fled their own country. not long ago. Though surrounded day by day by the war, one day the occupation will end with reconciliation and amends. The wall that divides will come tumbling down, and two people will be one. But till that day, I will continue to say, free Palestine, for they suffering so long. Free Palestine, for they suffering so long. Free Palestine, for they suffering so long. Nobody does anything about it, for they suffering so long, so long.
That was Mark Tetro and John Samad Diallo performing at SBHR's fundraiser last week. Welcome back to Under the Olive Tree. You're still listening to 90.3 FM CKUT Radio McGill in Montreal. Our first interview actually is with Professor Simona Sharoni. She will be speaking in Montreal at Concordia University with Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights Concordia next Tuesday, November the 29th, 2005. Her lecture will be on the challenge of solidarity, the struggle for peace and justice in Palestine. Professor Sharoni is an Israeli feminist, scholar, and a political activist. She has published widely on the gender dynamics in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in Palestine-Israel, as well as militarization and masculinity. Two of our collective members, Linda and Vivian Tabor, had the opportunity to sit down with her and discuss the themes of her upcoming talk and explore the question of militarization in Israel, feminist solidarity as well. She also went into her own personal experiences and her decision to leave Israel. So here we go. This interview was conducted, as we said, by Linda and Vivian Tabor, our new collective members in Montreal.
Can you just briefly introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Simona Sharoni, and I currently teach at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. I was born in Romania. My parents emigrated to Israel when I was 2. I lived in Israel most of my life. I was born Jewish, educated in Israel, and left in 1989 to pursue a doctorate in the U.S. in conflict analysis and resolution.
Professor Sharoni, you are giving a talk here in Montreal at Concordia next week. Can you briefly tell us a little about the issues you will be addressing in this lecture?
Well, I'm going to be speaking on November 29th, which is International Day for Solidarity with the Palestinian People. So the theme of solidarity is going to be one of the central themes of my talk. And I will try to contemplate a larger question, and that is, how do we as people connect with other people's struggles? How do we more specifically locate the question of Palestine in relation to questions of social justice globally? Because for me, one cannot claim that they work for social justice locally or globally without embracing Palestine. The injustices are just so grave that turning away, not making it part of someone's work, leaves the work incomplete. And I will try and explain why this has been the case for me, kind of using my unique life story, but also making the point that we all have stories. Those of us that already do Palestine work have the personal reasons that brought us to the issue. And those that are curious because they heard about it and they never had an opportunity to learn the fact, are in a good place to make a personal connection. I really believe in it because there is relatively little information that is compassionate towards Palestinians in North America. And their views of the conflict are pretty much distorted, and the mainstream media gives people a sense that the issue is way too big and way too complicated for them to comprehend, and most people don't get involved in issues that they feel that they don't understand, because we don't like to be exposed as not knowing the facts. So what I would like to, what I intend to do is to simplify the conflict for people by providing a personal entry point, but also give an update on what's happening on the ground right now. Things happen as we speak with the changes in the kind of Israeli political landscape in terms of the main parties. People have gone a lot of images around the Gaza disengagement and have tuned out, not realizing that the occupation continues pretty much everywhere and that Gaza has been under siege since the disengagement. So, you know, I intend to weave into the personal narratives and the presentation of simple facts, some vignettes of kind of an eyewitness experiences from my trip to Palestine and Israel this summer.
You have also written about militarization. You have also touched upon the centrality of the role of the military in Israel. Can you talk about the militarization of Israeli society, specifically in context of this intifada? And can you also tell us about your own personal experience as someone who has served in the Israeli army?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that when I talk about militarization, in the context of my recent trip, the first thing that comes to mind is getting off the plane with my 5-year-old daughter and seeing how shocked she was at young people carrying guns. She particularly looked at the women and she said, "Mama, why are they carrying guns?" And I mean, the question didn't take me by surprise because I've been preparing for a while as to how to explain that to her, because she knows that guns are bad. And but I also flash back to when I was that 19-year-old woman carrying the machine gun, convinced that that weapon will protect me, will protect my people. It gave me a lot of hope that Nadia was uneasy about it and scared of the gun, because in her world, guns are the source of insecurity, not of security, which is what, in a decent world, everybody should feel. But in a militarized country, you don't even see this, because you know, part of how militarization works, and we see it a lot in the United States post 9/11, is that the world is divided into us and them, and them pose a threat, so we have to do whatever we need to do to protect ourselves. And then people become uncritical and oblivious to the toll that militarization takes on us. It completely distorts the way the world look, so then you take a gun that that kills, and you think about this as something that will protect your life, and rather than eliminating the conditions that produce the insecurity and the fear. It is, for me, I mean, with the second intifada, it's been militarized. Because of the, I'll rephrase it, because of the ongoing militarized repression that Israel is engaged in the West Bank and Gaza, and to some extent against Palestinians inside Israel as well, the reaction, particularly as what was put forth as peace proposal, failed to deliver what people have struggled for. and conditions that allow people to live in peace and dignity, the response on the Palestinian side has been militarized as well. The result has been that, you know, the conflict has taken a heavier toll in people who are dead and injured, but also that in terms of community involvement, it silenced people in both communities that don't see military solution as an avenue that will lead to a just and lasting solution to the conflict. And I rarely use the term two communities because it's too easy slides into this notion that we have a symmetrical conflict. We don't. But I think that it's been much more difficult that basically the largely nonviolent resistance that characterized the first intifada for Palestinians, because the Israeli public and the Israeli governments and the world community failed to grasp the message that was basically a message of, you know, and the occupation. It was a very strong anti-colonial message, and the peace proposals failed to deliver what they deliver. We ended up with something that was militarized, because the forces that advocated a military solution took advantage of the vacuum and basically registered their mistrust in any diplomatic solutions or grassroots solutions. Militarization. I could do a whole talk about militarization. I think that in addition to the toll that it takes on people that are at the receiving end of those deadly weapons, it takes a toll on the people that use the weapons, because it dehumanizes people. When you look at someone through the barrel of a gun, you see them as a target. You stop seeing them as human beings, as people who love and play music and have hopes for the future. You basically see them as a threat to your own security. So that it takes a toll on the person carrying the gun as well. And I definitely remember it, not so much from my own personal experience, but from working, from seeing what happened to 18 and 19-year-old men after their basic training in the Israeli military. And I've seen this. This was my entry point when I was 18 and a half into the toll that militarization takes on Israeli Jewish soldiers themselves. Again, I think that my concern primarily is with the damage that those weapons do when they get fired on innocent people, and the devastation that they wrought in Palestine, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, etc. But I think it's important in developing an anti-militarization critique to point out that the person that carries the gun, that learns to view the gun as providing security, gets dehumanized in the process as well. And the other area that is very close to me, that I have done considerable work in, is the relationship between the violence that is legitimized by militarization and violence against women and children. And I had the opportunity this past quarter to supervise student teachers on a military base, the second largest military base in Washington State, Fort Lewis. And I got to see kids in fourth grade in an elementary school on the base and watch closely what happened to them as they anticipated, I would say, with much trepidation and fear, the return of their fathers from Iraq. And the stories that they told in confidence to my student teacher and myself about what happened in their household when their traumatized fathers returned from Iraq So there's a correlation that by now is documented both in the United States and in Israel between the service or the service of, let's say, Israeli Jewish men in the West Bank and Gaza and the rise in reported cases of domestic violence inside Israel when those men return home. And it's very similar in the United States with soldiers that return from Iraq and from Afghanistan. So violence is violence and is violence, and when you learn to accept violence as a solution to problems, it's very difficult to change the way you look at the world. Once you take your uniform off, it in a way becomes, the barrel of the gun, even when you don't physically hold it, becomes the lens through which you look at the world. And then, you know, if you approach things with fear rather than with compassion and with openness, the result is that you basically end up reproducing and reinforcing violence rather than alternatives to it.
Reading your blog, you mentioned that you grew up in Nazareth Elite, which you have described as a segregated environment. You spoke of your own awareness of the racism in kindergarten and the use of language such as dirty and primitive to refer to the Arabs. What was it like to grow up in this environment? How did this personally impact on the development of your own political and feminist consciousness?
I go back and I see more vividly pictures from my own childhood as I watch my daughter, who is just in kindergarten, interact with other kids and embrace difference. It's very painful to look back and admit that you were implicated in a racist culture, that, your parents were racist. I'm saying for me, it's very painful because I think they were not aware. And in the same way that I think racism is very much connected, some of the glue, racism and sexism and homophobia, help cement militarization and vice versa. For them, they were protecting me. They wanted me to be around people that were like me because they were ignorant to the similarities between me and, you know, Middle Eastern Jewish kids, the Moroccan kids that were in the neighborhood. And they failed to see those people as allies. And they had no idea, they didn't want to know, that we were indeed guests, probably on your family's land, that we were settled there on land that was stolen from other people. And the only reason that we had to be scared is because we stole something that was not ours. And when you steal something that is not yours, the person whose land it is, sooner or later would want it back, or at least would want some kind of a compromise that will allow them to enjoy the fruit of the land as much as you do. It's more painful to look back at those memories with a critical eye than to have lived them. Because as I analyze it, as people become aware of their racist genealogy, there is the sense of guilt. Now that I've put 26 years of my life into trying to undo some of that damage, I'm less burdened by the guilt and more by this sense of responsibility and urgency to act and to change things. And that's what makes it hard for me to see that very little has changed in Nazareth Elite. It was painful to go back to the house that I grew up in, to the same neighborhood, and hear people talk openly about their prejudices against their Palestinian neighbors who have moved into the apartment building because they cannot afford, because there are no apartments available in Nazareth. They're kind of self-centered, bigoted, isolated worldview, and it bothers me in particular because those are working class poor people. Those are immigrants that were seduced by the promises of Zionism that were empty promises for most people, definitely for Middle Eastern Jews, but also for working class immigrants from Eastern Europe, which is where my family came from. And I think that the fear that was produced and played upon by the Israeli political system and Israeli popular culture for years has cemented the kind of racism and segregation that marked my childhood in Nazareth. So, I mean, the only glimpse of hope for me was in taking my daughter back and taking the bus that I took as a child to Nazareth and explaining to her as we stood in the bus stop and she was wondering about how congested transportation was in Nazareth, why there are no resources that go into the infrastructure in Nazareth. And having her say it's not fair in English and having Palestinians in the bus stop kind of look half bewildered and then smile as they hear that her name is Nadia. There are certain things that I try to do that I call my daily acts of resistance that I think are subversive. Because for years I was so ashamed that I was part of that kind of racist, segregated outpost. That I wouldn't tell Palestinians that this is where I grew up. And it was a close Palestinian friend of mine who grew up in Mashhad, in the village right on the outskirts of Nazareth, who asked me to tell people. They said, I grew up, you grew up in fearing me, and I grew up fearing you. But I never, he said, I could never imagine that there, you know, that there could be any change, that people in Nazareth elite could grow up and change the way you do. So you have to tell people you're from there because they're going to see more than that. And it took me years to be able to make peace with that, as to be able to make peace with my last name that is Shavoni and immediately, you know, invokes the connotation of the, you know, infamous war criminal that is now, you know, starting a new party, and the polls today say may win a third term. And, you know, and that's the last name. That's the last name that my dad chose when my family immigrated to Israel, and he was told by an immigration official that he should have a Hebrew name. And, you know, I've spent so much time thinking about, well, you know, I could choose another name. And it would be easier, but I think that the difficult task is to own what was given to us and then try and transform it. So you know, those are the materials that I have to work with and rewrite my life story with, and going back to Nazareth Elite and Nazareth as the person that I am right now is part of the journey. But you know, it involves being humble and honest and asking forgiveness realizing that we can only act based on what we know. And I simply did not know. And I did not know because I was manipulated by a system that did not want me to know, that did not want me to relate to my neighbors as neighbors, that forced me to see them as inferior and fear them. And, you know, and so for me, there is, it's very clear that there are other ways, that there are other ways to educate young people, that difference is a source of strength, is not the source of weakness, that racism, like militarization, like any type of discriminatory idea produces more fear and insecurity than helps protect anyone. And so as an educator, as a parent, as a feminist, the difficult work is to have people become aware of how their own life story is implicated in the structure, and look critically at our baggage, at the racism and sexism and militarization and homophobia that we have internalized, and then begin to use that story as a way to transform other people, our community, and advocate for those issues. I mean, I really believe that starting with where discrimination and oppression touched us, not only as victims, but also as perpetrators, is a place where social change can begin.
Wake up. Wake up, wake up. The universe is upset. The world is in chaos. We are fighting the battles against the evil. Wake up, wake up, wake up. People are starving. People are dying. People are crying. People are trapped. People are fighting. Wake up, wake up, wake up. No longer can we make boundaries. No longer can we stand and watch. And no longer can we turn a blind eye to the injustices of the world. Wake up, wake up, wake up. The world has become a genocidal fuck up. Wake up, people. We've lost too many costs. When will these power mongers shut the hell up and realize that we have civilizations to revive? Civilizations that have the potential to strive in a world where only the strong survive, and even sometimes they fumble. Wake up, wake up, wake up. The universe is upset, and we are her soldiers.
That was Raya Hamdan performing at SBHR's fundraiser entitled We Shall Remain last week, November 17th at the Sala Rosa. Welcome back. You're still listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, Radio McGill in Montreal. You are still listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestinian Canadian radio show. Our next interview is with Darren L., a Montreal photographer. He traveled throughout Palestine in 2002 and 2003. He will be holding an exhibition on the 29th of November till the 1st of December, held in coordination with SPHR UCAM. The event is held in J.A. DeSave Theatre, 320 St. Catherine West, 10 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon, at University du Québec à Montréal, Metro Barrie UQAM. The exhibition was made possible by SPHR in UQAM and CPF, the Canadian Palestinian Foundation, PAJU, Palestinian and Jewish Unity, CUPERG, Concordia, CUPERG, McGill, Defense for Children International, PINGON, Palestinian Network of Environmental NGOs, and PARC, Palestinian Agriculture Relief Committees. The interview was conducted by our Montreal collective members, Sabine Friesinger and Hanin. They're both our new members in our collective again. So it's a great interview. We'll listen to it now.
Earlier this week, Hanin Amorov met up with teacher and photographer Darren L., who will be holding a photo exhibit entitled Twice Removed at UQAM next week. Join us under the olive tree.
Why specifically Palestine? Why the Palestinian issue interested you and got you really into it?
Probably a few reasons. I had been reading about it for a number of years. Mm-hmm. I've read about many, many issues around the world, but this was one that I sort of decided to specialize on. There was a very active, very large community, both Jewish and Arab Palestinian, in Montreal, so that gave me access to people and information. And I think I understood the issue, or I felt I did anyway. I mean, it's a complex issue. There's multiple points of view, but I've always sort of started from a kind of a human rights point of view, and then I move into an issue from there. And I felt I had a good understanding of some of the larger issues involved. So I decided that I felt confident enough to move into it with a camera and to represent it, I think, fairly and intelligently.
That's very nice. And when you got there, like when you started taking these photographs, what kind of impact did it have on your feelings? What kind of emotions did you get from seeing these
situations?
These situations.
I guess the first thing that affects a person when they come from a place like Canada, where things are relatively stable and peaceful, one feels very secure in Canada. The effect of going, well, there's two things. One is going, first of all, from Israel to the Palestine or the occupied territories. That's an experience in itself, because Israel is a very different place than Palestine. And so one goes from a place where one, you feel relatively secure in Israel. You feel comfortable. There's all the luxuries of the Western world are there. You can go and have a beer if you want. You can sit in a restaurant. You can go to a movie. I mean, there's all sorts of things you can do. And things change when you all of a sudden have to cross a checkpoint. You're aware of something very different going on. You feel very fragile. You feel very powerless. You realize that your destiny is not necessarily in your own hands. And so immediately the dynamics of your day-to-day life change. And then when you get into to Palestine, you're aware that that can change at any minute. I mean, all of a sudden a helicopter flies by, or a tank rolls by, or that the city is shut down, or there's shooting. It's a very different world. And and what happens too is you realize the absolute difference between those two worlds, not only in terms of security, but in terms of standard of living, in terms of levels of poverty, in terms of levels of frustration, in terms of the physical landscape is very different. And so you get a sense, overall, you get a sense of the reality of the situation. It's not just reading anymore. It's not just stories in a newspaper or a book. All of a sudden, you're looking at destroyed fields, exploded homes. You're looking at people standing by watching bulldozers mow their homes down. You are confronted with a geographic, a sense of the geography of it, a sense of the extent of what remains to be done. Just looking out, for example, over the city of Gaza, where you see thousands and thousands and thousands of homes with rebar sticking out of the top of the house, where these homes have not been finished. That you can tell that there was a sense of, oh, we're going to build a home, and then we can't build a home anymore. And it's everywhere, all throughout the Gaza Strip. You see it in the West Bank. So there's a sense of thwarted development something that's trying to happen but is not happening.
And I imagine that, I know you already took pictures of refugees in the refugee camps. And did you have the chance, like, to encounter these people and to communicate with them? And do you know anything about their situation, and what do they feel about all this?
Yeah, quite a few. I worked in several ways. The first was I worked with the Defense for Children International, the DCI, and we met seven different families in the West Bank. These were families that had children, well, not all of them. One of the families was a family that was, first of all, they're all families that had lost their homes. And DCI deals with children, so they deal with children's rights. So, a fundamental right is a right to a home. So one of the families that's in my exhibition, is a family that was in Jenin, in the refugee camp of Jenin, which was, the heart of it was kind of obliterated in 2002. The family's home was basically in the path of a bulldozer. So, the Israeli army was bulldozing homes to sort of make a corridor for tanks to move around the refugee camp. So this family's home was bulldozed, and now they're in a UN supply apartment. And I had a chance to sit down with them for a better part of an hour and ask them questions and interview them. And then I interviewed about six other families. These were families whose one son or more sons, had been involved in military activities. So they had been in clashes with the military, Israeli army, gun battles, or in one case, one of the sons was organized. Was involved in organizing incursions into Israel, which resulted in killing and wounding of Israeli civilians. Mm-hmm. So I was interviewing these families, and their the result in each of these cases was that the family home was blown up by the IDF. Mm-hmm. So once that there's a, this is a law in Israel, which is, I believe it's still suspended, it's been suspended for a number of months, that if, you know, the son commits a crime, then the family's home is blown up. So yeah, I had a chance to talk to these people.
And is there a specific moment during you taking pictures that really grasped you and that you will remember forever, let's say?
Yeah, there was a couple. One was taking a picture of a woman the opening image in this exhibition. A woman, and it was my first time that I was in a, I guess call it a war zone or an area where there was gunfire and so forth. Then it was in the in Rafah, which is the southern city of the Gaza Strip. This is a city where Rachel Corrie, the American activist, was killed in this about a month, I guess a month before I was there, in the same neighborhood, and in this neighborhood, this is right along the Egyptian border. This is where Israeli tanks were taking away homes, Palestinian homes, under the pretext that there were tunnels underneath the border between Egypt, and that arms were coming in, so they wanted to destroy homes so they could find a way to find these tunnels and blow them up and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I was in this neighborhood going from sort of destroyed home to destroying home, photographing what was going on, and I came upon a number of families just sort of, it was a terrible place. I mean, you had families sitting on just sort of, you know, little lawn chairs watching their homes be destroyed while there was the occasional local guy with a gun, with an AK-47, trying to protect the neighborhood and keep kids away from the area of the bulldozers, because the bulldozers, of course, are guarded by snipers and gun towers and so forth around the neighborhood. So it's a very dangerous area, and I came into one home, and the whole wall, southern wall, had been removed, and there was an elderly woman dressed in black with her family there, her daughter and her children, and they were just watching the bulldozer go by, and this woman was crying, and I photographed her, and she's actually in the exhibition. This was a very strange, it's something you don't forget, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. Here's a woman who I assumed I didn't have a chance to talk to her. I was moving, you know, I was there maybe 15 minutes, and then I moved on, and she didn't speak English, but I mean, I would assume that this was a woman. She was in her, I think, 60s. Probably had been moved once in 1948, and now was being moved again. Mm-hmm. So it was at least losing her home twice to some of these crimes.
And when you encountered these people, what was their impression seeing a Westerner coming from North America and like being interested in their issue? What kind of impression did they get from that?
Always very good, quite honestly. It was always very, there's a great openness to it. She certainly didn't, and the family certainly did. I made a gesture that I would like to take photographs, and they just said, yeah, go ahead. And in all of the situations with the families, they were fine. I mean, I photographed them in the ruins of their homes, and they were fine with that. They were very open in discussing their situation. Probably the best example was in Rafah. The day before I had gotten to Rafah, there had been a young boy, a two-year-old boy, killed by bullets that were coming in from the Israelis were shooting into the neighborhood. And this boy had been struck with a bullet in the chest, and he was killed. And his mother was wounded critically. She was she had shrapnel in the sort of abdomen and thighs, and was just about killed, and she was in the hospital. So I found out about the story, and I went in and met with the doctors, and the family said, yeah, sure, take her picture. She was unconscious at that time. I took her picture and published her story online. And then the next day I went to the funeral for the boy and photographed that. That's online as well. It's a very sad event, and I mean, so here we are going into photograph a funeral. This is what a lot of photojournalists end up doing in these areas. They photograph funerals. It's been done a lot, you can't imagine doing that here in Montreal. It's a very odd thing to do. You can imagine a stranger from another country coming in and photographing your nephew's funeral. I mean, mm-hmm. that's something that just wouldn't be done, but here was a very different reaction. I came right up and I took some very close shots. I'd never met these people. And at the end, the guy I'd hired to drive me around Rafah, was my interpreter as well, And at the funeral, at the end of the funeral, they were helping the father. The father was extremely distressed, and they were helping him move away. And one of the men that was helping him said something quite angrily to me, and I was immediately quite concerned that I had offended them. So I asked my interpreter what he had said, and what he had said was, please use your photograph to tell the world what Israel has done. So it wasn't anger directed at me, it was anger directed at the situation. So I think in situations like this where you have people in distress, they see the camera as a window.
And some, like with your exhibitions, what kind of message do you want to, you know, get to the Canadians and Quebecers? What kind of message do you want to give them by presenting these pictures?
I think that there's something very sad about the photograph. There's something quite haunting in the sense that there's these empty spaces. It's a story of, it's called Twice Removed, is the title of the work Twice Removed, which in English is a term that we use for family. You know, he's my cousin, twice removed. You know, there's this sort of family connection to things. So there's an issue of family here. This is about families. It's about homes. And the idea of removal, people are literally being removed from their homes. If you look at, for example, the history of the Palestine since 48, 67, you just watch the map shrink. It just shrinks. It keeps shrinking, and it's still shrinking, and it's being circled by a wall. Homes are being destroyed still. I mean, there's something called disengagement a while ago, and removal of, you know, the Israeli settlers and so forth, but land is still being taken, homes are still being destroyed. Just that we don't get this information through the mainstream media. So my intent is to sort of inform people about, I think, what is really behind the whole conflict at this point. There's many sources to it. There's geopolitical concerns, there's American involvement, there's Israeli Zionist plans for this and that. But I mean, what's fueling the things that people are seeing on television? What people see on television are suicide bombs. This is what the Canadian public largely sees, and they get frightened and they go, oh my God, the suicide bomber, the terrible suicide bomber. Well, there's a reason for a suicide bomber in my understanding of the world, that people don't naturally grow up to want to put explosives around their body and blow themselves up. That's not a natural human evolution, so there's things that influence that. And my sense is that there are reasons for that, and I think I'm getting at some of them here. If you destroy people's homes, if you blow up their homes, if you destroy their land, if you take away their hope for a future, and if you do that for 40 years, this isn't last year or 2 years, it's 40 years, this is two generations of human beings that day in, day out, wake up and have trouble going to work, have trouble getting health care, women are giving birth at checkpoints, or their homes are being destroyed. They wake up and there's a bulldozer in their backyard. This happens day in, day out, all the time, and people don't know about it. And so what they know about is that there's some guy who's blown himself up. Well, that's an unfair representation of what is happening. So my sense is to give some voice to the things that I think are behind why people are blowing themselves up, which is the day-in, day-out grind of the occupation. And there's also information under the photos regarding even economic information. You know, what's it like to have your economy destroyed? You know, 50 to 70% unemployment all the time. Men unable to work, dads that are losing their jobs, the family tensions that this is creating. Kids can't go to school. I mean, there's so many issues. And so these photographs kind of touch on these issues. It's to sort of get a sense of, to get out the what many people tell the story. There's so many people working on this issue, but to tell a story that I often say, if I were to take pictures, and maybe I will do it, portraits of the families whose children have been, you know, or family members have been killed or maimed in suicide bombs. If I did an exhibition uniquely about that, it would still be the same story. Mm-hmm. The story is still about this occupation, which is driving people mad, and they're coming back in the way that, in the extreme way, is the suicide bomb, which causes all sorts of distress to Israelis. The story is the same story. It's still the story of this occupation, which is so devastating to Palestine.
Well, I hope that message will get through, and I want to thank you very much for having this interview with me.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I was speaking with Darren L. He's going to be presenting a photo exhibition called Twice Removed. It's going to be presented at Université de Québec à Montréal and the GA de Sèvres campus, which is on 320 St. Catherine East. It's going to be presented on November 29th and 30th and December 1st. It's an all-day event starting at 10 a.m. and I hope to see you all there.
You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM Radio McGill in Montreal. I'm Laith Maarouf, your host at Under the Olive Tree, Canada's Palestinian radio show. We will be listening to some of the poetry, the beautiful poetry that was recited by Rafif in last week's SPHR fundraiser titled We Shall Remain. Rafif is a poet from Toronto. She's Palestinian, born into refugee camps in Lebanon, but also she's a Canadian citizen. And she talks from the heart, talks of her experiences and the experiences around her that Palestinians live through. Again, thank you for being with us. And here is Rafif.
Let me start with this poem. This poem starts up with a Palestinian song. That says, I would rather die than live under occupation. Yes. Ya mom, wain ila hawa? Ya mom, waliya? Udarbi al-khana jirwala hukminna dilbiya. They tell me spoken word is meant to have rhythm and a beat. So take my heartbeat to every mother in Palestine, Iraq, Afghanistan. This one goes out to the woman I never got to meet, stolen from me by a sniper's bullet. May her soul rest in peace. And may the man responsible for what happened to us that September 16th, 1982, one day face justice. I want to write a poem as strong as my grandmother's arms after harvest, as humble as my grandfather's smile when they stole his land. I want to write a poem to the rhythm of, oh, Canada, not your home and not your native land. You stole it from the indigenous and put them on reservations, and that dream catcher in your Cherokee Jeep ain't making things better. I want to write a poem as loud as the thud Che Guevara's body made when it hit the ground, so it could walk up to the gates of the White House, rattle them screaming, George Bush, you're full of crap. And Kerry, you aren't that much better either. I want to write a poem violent like a bulldozer, so maybe, just maybe, people can understand why we Palestinians stick our ground and die under the rubble of our own homes, not leaving for a third time. Not leaving for a third time. I'm not a 48 Palestinian, 67 Palestinian, refugee Palestinian. I'm a free Palestinian. And I want to write a poem where the words sit down, smoke up, and conspire to make revolution. Where there are no more commas or question marks, just the beat of revolution in Gaza City and the rattling beat of Palestinian rocks on Israeli tanks. So let's sit down together tonight and write this poem. Please don't be scared by this next poem I'm going to do. It's just how I feel every time a Zionist comes up to me after an event to speak to me and accuses me of anti-Semitism. I just wrote this to them. Because usually they've lived in Palestine, probably near a place I can never return to. I am your savage, your terrorist. I am your savage, your terrorist. I am your savage. You're a terrorist, demographic threat, born to a demographic threat. And guess what? I will give you your next demographic threat. Wrap her in a hatta and name her Yaffa. Wait till you meet my baby girl. My mother rubbed olive oil on my hair and in my skin until the smell of Palestine seeped through to my veins. I have an immune system you can only dream of. You try living on anarwaful and hummus your entire life, fucker. And you should see the anay in my mukhayyam. I lived a refugee while you took my home, and they tell me you're Polish? What the hell are you doing here? Don't you see? The color of my skin is the color of the soil in Palestine, and every rock in Jerusalem knows my last name. Every wave hitting the Haifa shore is waiting for me to return, and I will return, and I'll always be on your mind. In the stones of your homes, in the cactus plants, I will always be on your mind. I am your savage, your terrorist. I am your savage, your terrorist. And I will always haunt you. I will always haunt you. I will always haunt you until I return. How many Palestinian refugees in the room? I need to hear screaming. This is for every one of us Palestinians that has to stand in a line at every stupid immigration officer. And we have to prove ourselves and prove where we're from. And I wrote this poem the night I heard Ahmed was stopped in a Montreal subway. So this one is for Ahmed. Tonight, in a Montreal subway, they picked up Ahmed, guilty of being here when there is no there for him to go to. Refugee camps are not our homes. Refugee camps are not our homes. Tired of the limbo, waiting for 57 years for another deportation order, another detention cell. Tonight, in a Montreal subway, they picked up Ahmed. Where is Mahmoud Darwish tonight? Wake him up, ask him to write a poem about Ahmed al-Arabi, Ahmed al-Za'tar, Ahmed Jinin, Ahmed Ain al-Hilwe. Let these words fill every immigration office with anger. You don't want us to stay here, they don't want us there. There is occupied by them, and them won't let us return. Don't send him anywhere but Palestine, if you dare. And I see them, straining, confused. Why are these Arabs angry? Don't they get it? We talk peace here. Why can't they just talk about their fine hummus and baba ganoush? Oh, that tabbouleh is so great. Just let the falafel go because it's Israeli now. So confused, they ask us to collectively give up. Lift our heads up to the F-16s that are showering us with death. Put up peace signs and sing, imagine all the people. Where the fuck are the people? Where the fuck are the people? When hundreds of Ahmeds are beating at the open bars in open air prisons, refugee camps, and detention cells, where the fuck are the people? We are sitting here chanting, let us go to Palestine, if you won't let us stay, because there's no place for us here or there, and here is there, and here is everywhere, and there's no place for us to stay, and we're stateless. And tonight, they picked up Ahmed in a Montreal subway. Were you sleeping, talking pacifism, or were you with us, fighting our fight? Thank you.
That is the end of our show. You are still listening to CKUT Radio McGill 90.3 FM in Montreal. Again, my name is Laith Maarouf. I'm your host at Under the Olive Tree, the Canadian-Palestinian radio show in CKUT. If you'd like to join our collective or help in our productions, please email us at uot@ckut.ca. Again, that's uot@ckut.ca, or call us at 398-6788. Thank you very much for being with us. Until we meet under the olive tree, I bid you salam, free Palestine.